I got into this subject, as I said last night, based on some personal experience and based on some investigation that I did over the course of the last year. And what I concluded was that we have, certainly in this country, moved a long way from the origins of how we as a society and how we as a community have resolved disputes in the past. We have moved to a very almost complicated system, a very procedural system for resolving disputes, a system that is based on an antagonistic relationship between two parties. In fact, most people will tell you when they go to law school that the notion of conflict, the notion of win-lose, is embedded in the process. It's a fight to the finish. It is a fight for somebody to win out and be a victor over someone else. And yet, when we go back in time and we look at some of the origins of disputes and dispute resolution in the United States and in most other small community environments, we find that the attitude taken towards disputes is quite different. Now, let me start off by very briefly summarizing. I don't know if you can read this. I can't. I had to write it backwards, and I'm not very legible anyway. That's why I have computers. Why the cost is so high for legal conflicts, for disputes that are settled through the legal process. More and more over the last, certainly, 30 years, we have seen the growth in lawsuits. And we talk about the, there's a variety of books that have been written on the subject. But basically, they all have the same theme. We've got lawsuit happy. We sue over everything and anything at the drop of a hat. I happen to come from California, where it is probably 4 or 5 times what it would be back in the Midwest, where I grew up in Illinois. But the tendency to sue has become more and more prevalent. And what I've listed on here is some of the reasons why we have this tendency and why we spend such a high percentage of our national wealth and income on dispute resolution. Now, I threw out a figure in the last session last night, which really is startling. A professor from the University of Texas compared to the United States, to most of the other industrialized countries, and concluded that we have approximately 60% more lawyers than we optimally should have. And he concluded that there is a useful role for lawyers to have in a society to help maintain order, to help resolve issues between parties that are distressed, and also from a commercial perspective, lawyers are useful in contracting, maintaining orderly business relationships, and so forth. But what he said was, once you fulfill those basic requirements, every lawyer you add tends to create a set of problems that take you beyond that optimal role. And he concluded that the cost of that process and that legal system in the United States for 1990 was about $600 billion. Now, to put that in perspective, that's the equivalent of $2,500 for every working American, which is roughly equivalent to what every working American who has health insurance pays for it, or their employer pays for it. So we're talking about a lot of money, all right? Even in a large economy the size of the United States, $2,500 per working American is a lot of money. And if you could have that in your pocket, you'd be a whole lot better off. Worse than that is it's growing. It's growing at about 9% a year. Now, given that our economy is growing about 7% a year or 6% a year in nominal terms, this means that the cost of this legal processing is growing at about 1.5 times the economy as a whole.
which means that it's taking and consuming more and more resources. Now, the reasons for this are many, but some of the obvious ones are it's easy to pass laws. I mentioned last night that when the United States was an emerging nation, we had three federal laws, three things that you could do to break the law. You could counterfeit, you could commit treason, or you could be a pirate. And only those things would cause the Department of Justice and a U.S. attorney to go after you. Today, there are 3,000 federal laws that you can violate, for which an assistant attorney general can go after you. I don't know what they all are. You don't know what they all are. And when you commit one of these felons, you probably won't know it. But if somebody catches you, you might get in trouble. The second part of the problem is that when we pass laws, sometimes we make them very ambiguous. Now, why would we pass an ambiguous law? Because typically when we pass a law, there are two parties, one that wants it and one that doesn't want it. The best way to pass a law is to make the glass look half full. And to make the glass look half full, you make it ambiguous. Both sides look at the glass and say, gee, it's half full. Or they say it's half empty. That makes it look like both sides have won. Congress knows this. The lawyers on the staff of the congressional committees that draft the laws know this. And it's going to take a legal process to resolve the ambiguity. So we end up with ambiguous laws which require a lot of adjudication to resolve exactly what the Congress meant to begin with. And that's why we talk about a legal system and why we talk about many courts being very aggressive, in other words, being very litigative, being almost legislative in their role in society. We say courts shouldn't legislate, but yet we force them to legislate because we write laws that aren't clear. And the Congress knows that the Congress is passing laws that are ambiguous because they don't want to face the music and sign their name to a law that's clear because it's going to make somebody mad. The third part of it is that the legal system is process-oriented. It is a very carefully designed process of procedures. Every state set of laws and all of the lawyers that practice in a state are bound by a state set of legal procedures. And of course, the federal law has a set of legal procedures that bound the actions of the lawyers involved in any federal legislation or federal litigation. That system has become increasingly more complicated as the years have gone by. The federal code of procedures that defines what lawyers can do is a set of procedures that basically comes through a congressional committee. It's written by lawyers and then codified by your judiciary committees in the Congress, and then they become binding on the system. But we'll talk a little bit about some of those procedures along the way. In fact, let me mention just a few that have become very, very significant in the last few years. I would hazard a guess that several of you in this room within the last 12 months have gotten a very complicated looking legal document that says that you are a plaintiff in a lawsuit against several United States airlines. How many of you have received that? Okay? What that document said was that you didn't know it, but you had hired a lawyer. And that lawyer, that legal firm, happened to be one in San Francisco, I believe, had a plaintiff who they had some relationship with or they advertised for, who knows how they got them. And they claimed that several American Airlines, United, Delta, a few of the large ones, had fixed prices sometime back in 1988, 89, between various routes, between various cities. And because one plaintiff only maybe flew three times, the claim that they had against these airlines was de minimis. Let's face it, maybe it amounted to $3, right? So it doesn't pay to go to a lawyer, hire a lawyer, and say, I want to sue these airlines for price fixing, alleged price fixing, by the way. We haven't proven it. And the lawyer says, look, I'm not going to take the case. There's not enough in it for me. So several years ago, the federal court permitted something called a class action. Class action simply says that if you can find one plaintiff, that plaintiff can act in the capacity of a whole class of people. In this case, everybody that flew American, United, or Delta between 1988 and 89 through Chicago, Atlanta, whatever the cities happened to be. And that particular law firm now represents several millions of people. Okay? We have to figure out who they are. That's not so easy to do. But the point is, that law firm is now taking on a case on contingency on behalf of everybody that flew in that airline. And the claim is that these airlines committed price fixing. Now, that opens up a lot of new lawsuits. Because now a lawyer can represent, or a law firm can represent, many individuals, and you don't even have to know that you're a plaintiff in the case. In this particular case, the airlines decided to settle the lawsuit for approximately $400 million. Now, the quid pro quo here is that $350 million of those was in the form of certificates, which you could fill out a form and say, I flew three times between Atlanta and Chicago, or I flew three times out of Chicago's O'Hare Airport, therefore I am a legitimate plaintiff in this lawsuit, and I'm going to get a certificate worth $75, which I can use to buy another airline ticket. The other part of the claim was $50 million in cash. What was the $50 million in cash for? Guess. $35 million for the attorneys, $15 million to send out all those pieces of paper to you. Well, class action suits have become very popular. My mother keeps getting these documents from her shareholder situations, and she gets them and she says, what does this mean? And they're typically shareholder lawsuits, very popular. If you have a share of stock and it drops in price, somebody will have sued that as company's management directors the next day, I guarantee you. Probably they've been sued three or four times, because all of these claims are put on word processors, and they change the name, and they run to the courthouse as fast as possible to be the first law firm to get their claim in so that they can represent the class. But the point is, a lot of new procedures have been developed over the years to make it easy to sue. Yeah.
Do you think it seems like the lawyers make these laws? Is it self-fulfilling to actually do this so that they can make more money? It almost seems that way sometimes.
Some people believe that.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't say one way or the other. The complaint. Do you know that it used to be that if you wanted to sue somebody, you had to have some evidence that the person had wronged you? Do you know that's not true anymore? You almost have total immunity today when you sue somebody. You can claim just about anything you want. If you are involved in a domestic dispute with your spouse, you can claim that that spouse has done just about everything under the sun, and you don't have to prove it in that complaint. In fact, you can make a whole litany of complaints about somebody that you think has wronged you, and none of those have to hold up, ultimately. It's only after discovery that you have to find something that you can take to court that will ultimately hold up. Now, why is that the case, and has it always been the case? The answer is no, it's not always been the case. It used to be that you had to have some fairly hard evidence before you could be permitted to make a complaint against another individual or corporation or whatever. But the laws have changed, the procedures have changed. And because those procedures have changed, it's become incredibly easy to sue. You can now sue without evidence that anybody has wronged you.
That doesn't necessarily mean that they would win the suit, though.
Absolutely not.
And isn't it true if they do lose the suit, they pay all the court costs?
In England, that's true, not in the United States.
That's true in the United
States. No, that's the English system. And people have advocated that the United States adopt the English system, but the United States has not adopted the English system. There is one of the, I'll get right to you. There is a procedure that basically says that if you submit a frivolous lawsuit, okay, if it's frivolous and it's found to be frivolous, then it is possible for you to get your attorney's fees returned if it is a totally frivolous lawsuit. It turns out, though, that in reality, very, very few frivolous lawsuits are ever detected or acted upon. So for the most part, when you sue with immunity.
Are you speaking mostly about state laws now, or?
State and federal.
State and federal.
Yep.
Are states pretty uniform on this, or do they vary from state to state?
I'm not an expert in state laws. Most of the states, though, are relatively closely patterned after the federal laws. But there are differences. The other thing that has happened is that the discovery process, let me tell you what discovery is. If you've not been in a lawsuit, you're lucky enough not to know. The discovery process is where you open your drawers, your file cabinets, your tape recorders, your notes, your ledgers. Anything you have, you have to open it up to the other party if they require that you provide that material for discovery purposes. There's virtually nothing that you own that is not discoverable in a lawsuit. And what has happened is that over time, the procedures involved in lawsuits has broadened. It used to be that there were documents that you could protect, personal documents that you could protect from the other party in the discovery process. But over time, those procedures have been loosened to the point where virtually all documents are discoverable. They may not all be made public, but most of them are discoverable. What that has done is make the discovery process, in many people's minds, a fishing expedition. We think you did something wrong, we don't know what it is, but we're going to discover it when we get all of your documents. I mentioned a lawsuit against IBM, an antitrust suit about 10 years ago. The discovery process involved 100 million documents. Now you figure, even at 5 cents a piece, that's a lot of documents. And if you pay some legal paralegal $50 an hour to read those documents, that costs a lot of money. Because why would you discover them if you didn't want to read them? Somebody's got to go through the process. So the discovery process is added to the costs and so forth. Another thing that's changed that's new is whistleblowing. Have you ever heard of the whistleblowing statutes? If you're an employee, you find that somebody in your corporation, business, has done something illegal, you blow the whistle, you tell somebody, the police or an assistant district attorney or whoever it might be, you tell them, we think that we saw Joe throw some cans of paint into the sewer. He's violated some anti-environmental law. And Joe finds out that you told the assistant district attorney and you get fired. You can now participate. First of all, you're protected under the law. Secondly, you can participate in any fine against Joe. In other words, you can become a party to the lawsuit and get up to about 30% of any claim or settlement that occurs as a result of that lawsuit. So now we can all snitch on each other. We've created an economic incentive to snitch. The other part of the process, which I mentioned yesterday, and I'm not going to talk about it much anymore, is the perverse incentives, the compensation system. Lawyers generally are paid by the hour, which means you get paid more the more hours that you spend on a case. It's hard to deny that that doesn't influence behavior. Similarly, we have lawsuits that are based on contingency, where the lawyer only gets paid if they get a settlement or win the suit. That creates another perverse incentive, and that is get it over quick, get it settled, get the money now and move on to another case, which sort of short circuits the effort to try to find truth in the process. And then finally, we have, as I mentioned last night, the judiciary is itself a bureaucracy. And I'll probably not have a chance to talk about it, but virtually everything that's done by the public sector is now being challenged by the private sector. Now let me explain briefly what I mean. We used to collect all of our garbage, for most of our garbage, with public employees. But what do we find in many cities today? In fact, most cities today. It's the private sector that is taking over most of the garbage collection. It used to be that we used to have, oh, what's another good example? Talk about police protection. Do you know we spend more on private protection than we do on public protection? We talk about we want more police, we want more protection, but we're getting it. We're spending more on private guards, security systems, than we do on our public law enforcement system. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, good or bad, but we as citizens have decided that the public system is not working as effectively as the private system. The public system has a policeman in a car or two in a car that come around about once every 2 days, but if we spend our money on a private system, we've got a guard there all the time, or we've got a security system there all the time. Increasingly, we are moving many activities from the public system to the private system because we don't believe the public system is providing the quality or the quantity of service or a cost-effective quantity and quality of service that we would like. That is also true in the legal system. And one of the things that I'll be talking about the next 2 days on Thursday and Friday is the use of private sector adjudication techniques. Arbitration, mediation, private judging, there's a whole bunch of them. But increasingly, we're finding that people that are involved in a civil dispute are looking at the legal system and saying, it's not working for me. It takes too long. It takes too much money. It creates an awful lot of terrible emotional hurt. I'd rather get it done some other way. And so there's a whole field of private dispute resolution that's growing up in this country. And it's one of the subjects of this book that I wrote, and one of the subjects that is going to become much more important as time goes on. Now, let me use an example for you, one that I think almost everybody in this room can relate to take all of this and bring it down to a level that we can all understand if we're having any trouble understanding it at all. I hope you aren't. We're talking about the cost of trying to resolve disputes using a system that we've created, which is a very bureaucratic system, calling a legal system. And what I've listed here are some of the costs, not simply out of pocket. I threw out a number, $600 billion. That's the out of pocket cost, all right? There are also many other costs that are not out of pocket. Regulatory burden. You're in the camping business. You must fill out forms. You must be subject to inspections. Right? All the above, right? Okay, that costs money.
And some more,
right. That costs money, okay? Anybody that's involved in an activity that is supervised by some government agency is going to face that. Part of that means some productivity loss because your people are involved in complying and not producing. Part of that has to do with compliance costs or avoidance costs. You simply don't do it because you want to avoid the problem. Maybe that was a productive activity, it may have been something that would enhance your productivity, but you don't do it because, gee, you might face some regulatory burden along the way. There are emotional costs. I had a friend of mine that I worked with, and I hadn't seen the fellow for about 3 years, and if finally we touched base one time and we had breakfast one Saturday morning, and I said, Steve, I said, what have you been up to? And he said, oh, I've been out consulting, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, but he said my marriage fell apart. And he said it was really an emotional experience. He said, but we were handling it very well. We decided that we would handle this in the least emotional way possible. So we sat down one Saturday afternoon. We put a one of those flip charts in the middle of the living room, and we just started going through all of our personal effects. And spouse would go first, and she went first, and she said, this is what I want, and then he put what he wanted. And we made a list, went right down as unemotional as we could. And he said, I had a lawyer that was going to process this, the state of California. I don't know much about it personally, but thank goodness. But went to a lawyer in the state of California and said, we've done it, okay? We have gone through this list of all of our personal possessions. We've done it in an orderly manner. All we'd like you to do is just fill out the paperwork and let us get on with the rest of our lives. And he said, I can't do that. And he said, well, why can't you do that? I can't represent both parties to an adversarial relationship, obviously. So you're going to have to get your wife to hire another lawyer. He said, okay, why don't you work with her? I know you and you know what we're all about. You work with her and get this done. I'll go out and get another lawyer and get this thing resolved. Well, they had another meeting after he had gotten his lawyer. And the first thing that happened was that the lawyer that had represented him now represented her, and she and he or she, whoever the lawyer was, said, we've got a problem here. This was all done under coercion. The wife here obviously did not have proper counsel when she went through this process. We got to start all over. Well, before long, there's a fight brewing in this room. And to make a long story short, cooler heads prevailed. They got out of the room. They got the documents signed, and they moved on with the rest of their lives. But that's not always the case. In fact, that's frequently not the case. And so here, a process the two people agreed to, presumably without coercion, turned into a legal battle with its attendant costs and so forth. As somebody that's been involved in legal disputes in a corporate environment, emotion just simply is involved, and it's wrenching on anybody that's been involved in it. There's some people that already know that some products are canceled, some products are delayed because of threat of legal suit. Professional liability has become an enormous field. Is anybody an accountant? Nobody's been involved in accounting? Well, let me list for you some of the costs associated with professional liability today. Even lawyers get sued on professional liability. But the biggest professional liability suits have been brought against accounting firms. All of these suits and settlements have occurred within the last 2 years. Coopers and Lybrand paid out $300 million for having been the primary accounting firm for a life insurance company in Florida. Arthur Anderson paid out $55 million for Lincoln Savings, and they are in the process now of paying out another claim of close to $400 million to the RFC because of Lincoln Savings. KP Marwick and Miller, KPMG, Pete Marwick, paid out $100 million to the RTC. Leventhal and Horwath went in bankruptcy because of legal liability. They're no longer one of the big eight, now the big six. Ernst & Young settled a lawsuit to the RTC for $400 million. These are big numbers, even for large law firms. So legal liability with respect to professional liability has become a very, very major area.
And that's the people that like audit corporations' financial reports and say, hey, we look over the books and
everything is,
you know, used to be sort of a rubber stamp sort of thing, and now there's now.
Well, I can assure you it's never been a rubber stamp. Anybody that's worked for a public corporation who's been audited by a public accounting firm knows there it's not a rubber stamp procedure. The second thing about it is every one of these claims was not settled without a lawsuit. It was settled out of court with both parties saying they're not guilty, okay? Or at least with the alleged parties saying they're not guilty. We don't know the extent to which there was negligence in these cases. All we know is that there's a bunch of law firm, or there's a bunch of accounting firms that don't want to go up against the government. All right? And rather than go up against the government, they just as soon settle and get on with the rest of their lives. And they're willing to pay a lot of money to do that. Now let me convert some of this to something that you're much more familiar with. We all have worked for a company or in a corporate environment or in a partnership environment at one point in our lives. And the laws with respect to employee-employer relationships have become some of the most complicated, most far-reaching of any that we have in the United States. And I'm going to recite for you a few laws. I don't even understand them all, but I will explain to you that if you are an employee or an employer, you are subject to these laws, all right? The post-Civil War civil rights laws, they were the initial laws passed after the Civil War dealing with discrimination. We then extended those with the civil rights laws of 1964 and 1991, expanded the groups. We have the Age Discrimination Employment Act. People like me, over 40, are now protected. The American with Disabilities Act, which was passed just a few years ago. The Rehabilitation Act of 1973 dealt with the handicapped. The Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986 has to do with and also ensure that some illegal aliens do not get jobs and so forth. We have the Equal Pay Act. We have the Worker Adjustment and Retaining Notification Act. We have the Employee Polygraph Protection Act. And we have the Whistleblower Protection Act. Now those are all federal laws that relate to relationships between employees and employers. And I defy anybody except a specialized legal attorney in employment practices or an HR, a human resource professional, to understand what this is all about. Yet, when we hire somebody, we are subjecting ourselves to all of this potential litigation that could come out of these laws.
Weren't they passed, though, because there was abuse?
Of course. Of course. All of the 3,000 laws that protect someone or something or some bird, environment, water supply, whatever, were passed because of an abuse, okay? I mentioned the other day that the Congress passed the law making it a federal offense to commandeer an automobile at gunpoint, carjacking. I also mentioned that in every state in the United States, it is already an offense to commandeer an automobile at gunpoint. You would be convicted in every state in the United States. The question is, why does the federal government now ask an assistant district attorney to now sue at the federal level what you would already be sued at a state level? There's a lot of duplication. The policemen in LA, of course, were first presented to a state jury, then presented to a federal jury, slightly different charges, to be sure. But the point is, there's so many laws that we commit a lot of resources.
Wouldn't making a federal law make available more resources, such as you don't have to extradite someone, cross state boundaries, FBI can become involved. Having a federal law, there's more resources to attack the problem.
Well, pardon?
Another thought, too. Now the civil rights work in Mississippi, where the state's laws didn't protect a number of people, but the federal law did.
No, that's right. You're absolutely correct. No law has been passed that I know of that there hasn't been some violation of somebody's rights in the minds of somebody, okay? That is true. But the cumulative effect of having 3,000 federal laws on the books that relate to violations of a federal statute where you can therefore go to court and an assistant district attorney will allege something against you has created a situation where there's not enough resources to effectively, effectively carry out all of that type of lawmaking. It's simply impossible to successfully do that. The only way that we do it is we pick certain areas that we want to have the attorney general's offices go after. Last night I mentioned the current one happens to be health insurance, medical fraud. That happens to be the big one right now. If you're if you happen to have been involved in medical fraud in the last year or two, look out, because the resources of the Attorney General's offices are now focusing on medical fraud. That's the hot button. But if those resources are now looking at medical fraud, there's some other federal law that doesn't have the resources. You can't effectively go after all of them. We don't have all the resources to do that. We're already spending $600 billion growing at 9% a year. And that means as a society, you've got to make your choices. But I don't deny that at one point in our history, civil rights at the federal level was comparable to medical fraud today. Okay? Needed to be done. My point is simply that there are not enough resources to resolve all of those disputes, all of those 3,000 laws, all at one time. The resources are not there. You wouldn't pay for them if somebody said this is what it's going to take. You couldn't, as a taxpayer, you couldn't afford it. Now, I'm not sure I know what the answer to that is, but I will give you some of the consequences of it. Let me briefly talk about one area that I found to be very interesting. I picked up a study by the Institute of Civil Justice, which is a, for lack of a better way to put it, is a subsidiary of the RAND Corporation. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of RAND Corporation. They are a think tank organization in California. RAND, I think, is located in Santa Monica. And they have an Institute for Civil Justice, which does very, very scholarly work looking at issues involved in the judicial system, judicial efficiency, and so forth. And they did a study on employee wrongful termination. It is against the law to arbitrarily fire somebody, all right, without cause. Now, wrongful termination is a statute that relates primarily to state law, not federal law. Okay? There is no federal wrongful termination outside of protecting certain classes, sex, age, and so forth. But we have, in varying degrees, everything from, in effect, right to fire states, like I think Arkansas is one of the last ones, where you literally can fire without cause, to areas or states that have very, very strong protections against firing, such as California. California probably protects its workers from arbitrary firing better than any other state in the union. And there's about, I think, about 10 or 15 states that have wrongful termination statutes about as strong as California.
Who needs their wrongful termination? Can the people lay off for like economic reasons and that sort of thing? That's outside, say, hey, your sales are down or whatever.
Right. There are some states, literally, that you can still fire a person because I don't like that blue shirt. You know, it just doesn't look good in our work environment. Bye. Okay? That would be zero protection under the law. At the other extreme, you have California where you literally have to fill out a file that carefully delineates why you have not been fulfilling your obligations as an employee.
What about layoffs? That is necessary in a reduction in force that's necessary, is it?
You're asking me to stretch my knowledge in areas that I don't have much knowledge. There is a law, which I mentioned briefly, that is the Worker Adjustment and Retaining Notification Act, which simply says that if you decide to have a reduction in force, a layoff of, I think it's more than 50 people within 90 days, you have to give those employees notification, and they have to get so many months of notification. Does anybody know more about this than I?
I think you have to give them like 60 days notice ahead of time that the factory's going down or lay off.
And then you have to, right.
Something like that.
Right. You have to give them a certain amount of pre-notification. But that has got a limitation based on number of employees in the layoff. So if you lay off in one location more than, I think it's 50 employees, within a 90-day period, you have to give them 60 days notice. That is not what I'm talking about.
You know, having documentation for firing somebody is generally a corporate requirement.
Right.
You know, rather than a legal requirement.
It's a corporate requirement because companies have gotten sued.
Well, but it's also to protect the employee from the boss that maybe doesn't act like he should.
Right.
You know, so he's required. He has to have just cause.
Right.
He has to demonstrate it to HR.
Right. And that
independent of any legal system.
Well, I don't agree with that. I would say most corporations adopted that system to protect themselves against wrongful termination legislation or suits that might occur because of an arbitrary supervisor.
That may be, but I'm saying that the government didn't make a law saying
no,
they had to.
No. Well, let me get to that by telling you about the results of the study. Basically, the study said, let's compare states that have very, very strong employee protection to states that have virtually no employee protection, and there's some states in between. Now, I'm not going to get into the specifics of what it meant to define a strong protection state from a weak protection state. Suffice to say, if you live in California, you're strongly protected. If you live in Arkansas, you have no protection at all right? And what they did is try to identify, by looking at specific cost factors, whether they could determine whether or not companies in states that have strong protection of their employees incurred higher costs than states that had weak protection for their employees. And what they concluded was that the out-of-pocket cost of an employer in a strong protection state is only slightly above the out-of-pocket cost of an employer in a weak protection state, which surprised them. In fact, they found that it costs about $100 per employee more in a strong protection state per year than in a weak protection state. But then they said maybe out-of-pocket cost isn't the whole issue here. So they started scratching below the surface, and they said, well, if you want to be in a strong protection state, you might spend money on prevention, filling out the files, making sure that there's adequate documentation. That costs money. It may also be that if you're in a strong protection state, you are less likely to fire people that should be fired. In other words, you carry the deadwood. Gee, this person is not living up to their requirements for the job, but I don't have the file filled out. We're just going to carry him on the payroll, try to make out as good as we can, because if we fire him, we're going to get sued. We can't afford to get sued. So we carry unproductive workers on the payroll. There's also perverse incentives. They found that their supervisors that want to do what's right for the corporation, have productive employees, who tend to be very aggressive in firing unproductive workers. But what they find is that those situations create animosity, sometimes they create lawsuits, and so the supervisors of those supervisors come down hard on them for being strong supervisors. And so the supervisors that are looking out most for the company are the ones that are hurt because they took strong action against weak employees, which is a perverse incentive, which leads to supervisors not supervising, right? They also found that there is a strong amount of evidence that in strong protection states, companies modify their employment practices. In other words, they're less likely to hire older workers because older workers are protected if they're over 40. And they're also less likely to hire women who might become pregnant. They are less likely to hire younger workers for a variety of reasons, because they don't have a long history of successful documentation. They don't have letters of reference. They don't have any proof that they are going to live up to the requirements of the job. So rather than hire them, they don't perform, and then you have to fire them, and then you get sued. Don't hire them to begin with, okay? They found the companies do all of those things. So they change their staffing policies, they change their hiring policies, or sometimes they just create a bigger hierarchy. You want to fire somebody, you got to take it to a committee. You got to take it up to some staff vice president, all right? So what they said is, you know, the out-of-pocket costs are trivial. We can't identify out-of-pocket as being a strong impact on a corporation. What we are finding, however, is that all these insidious behavior changes do add to the costs of these protective laws. And what they concluded was that in the state of California, the indirect costs of these protective statutes adds roughly 10% to the nominal wage of workers in California, okay? It has the impact of paying 10% more. It also has the impact of reducing the labor force in California by 2%. So the unemployment rate of 2% in California is roughly 2% higher because of efforts made to try to protect the existing labor force. Now, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, good or bad. The point is that by, over the years, adding protection after protection after protection, we would be naive in believing it doesn't change the way people behave, or that it doesn't change the economics of employment and employee-employer relations. It does. Even though we will all admit that every law has been passed with good intentions to protect workers against an evil that did occur. But when you add it all up, it has a cumulative impact that does have a rather significant impact on the way we as an economy perform, the way companies perform, and so forth. Have any of you experienced any of this?
Yeah. I've been a union president, being an educator, of course, with the teachers union, and seeing it from the side of representing some people who were unfairly fired for having armpit hair because they were female. And something we bring out a lot, you know, those are nice facts, but some principals, management, like to fire people because it's easier than helping them get better. Yet in education, it's much cheaper not to fire someone, but to help them get better. And the reason it's made so expensive to fire them is because principals tend to look at the bottom line sometimes, or the easiest way out, and that was to fire. So when you're looking at that, you know, 2% unemployment or, you know, the different things like that, did they take into consideration that it also saves business a lot not to fire people because they don't have to retrain? If they spent more time helping people get better than just a lazy manager turning over the workforce, how much do they save by doing that?
You made very good points. You made very good points. I believe as a school teacher that is represented by a union in the state of California, I'm one of the most protected workers in the world. And I believe that I should be, because my rights are important to me, okay? I appreciate the fact that I'm protected. But when you look at it from a macro perspective, the country, the city, the company, and you say to yourself, gee, 2% of the American workforce that would like to have jobs doesn't have them because we're protecting Ken. You have to take a different perspective to it. Okay, Protecting Ken is very important to Ken and to Darlene, my wife, and our two children. It really is. They can't think of anybody more worthy of protection. But when you take that protection to an extreme, so that by protecting Ken, there's three unemployed people in Los Angeles, who's protecting them? Okay. And that's where all of this becomes very muddy and very difficult to sort out. That's when it becomes very difficult, because those people are totally unrepresented in this room and in this discussion. Those people are totally unrepresented by the state of California, who hires me, the union that represents me, and the school that I work for. Those people aren't involved in the discussion. I'm involved, the union's involved, the state of California's involved. But those unemployed don't have a say. But I'll take it one even more significant step, and that is, there are workers in Thailand, and in Taiwan, and in Vietnam that want these jobs badly. And you know, they're willing to do those jobs without any worker protections at all. And what we're facing, we've been discussing NAFTA. I even heard somebody mention it in a prayer. There's a belief that we pass NAFTA, all of the jobs are going to go to Mexico, and we're going to have a lot more unemployed. The reality is that those jobs left a long time ago. And if they don't go to Mexico, they're going to go to Vietnam, they're going to go to Thailand, they're going to go to Singapore. I teach it. If the people in California knew what I do, they'd go crazy. I teach graduate students in finance. Roughly 50% to two-thirds of all my students are not from the United States. Most of my students are from Taiwan, Singapore, Thailand, get a few from the Philippines, one or two from Japan. Japanese can afford to go to better schools. They're coming over here. They're paying a trivial amount to send them to a state of California school. They're going back and they're becoming the supervisors of the banks, factories that are taking the jobs away, because those people are willing to work for less. That's the reality of it. I can't and you can't do anything about that. All we can do is work together to resolve conflicts without all of this deadweight cost. And that's my whole point. It's not to disagree with you. I don't disagree with you. My rights are important. But when my rights means that our people can't get employed or the jobs flee our country, then I think we've got to think about what the consequences are.
Consequences. When you said Arkansas has the least protection, right away the chicken place that burned down with the doors that were locked came to my mind, and I'm wondering, you know, that's another cost. So should we lower ourselves in the protection we give our workers to make sure that other people don't get them? No, I think we've built this to protect people.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It's not dead weight. It's important weight, because as humans,
but we're not,
we make bad choices.
Don't make the mistake of assuming we're disagreeing over the fundamental issue, which is safety, right? Which is discrimination, which is protecting people against some crazy supervisor who's arbitrary and capricious. I don't disagree with you on those grounds. That's not the point. The point is how we resolve conflict. If we pass laws that increase the cost of a worker in California by 10%, that results in a 2% decline in employment, we ought to start saying maybe there's a better way to protect the worker than going and filing a lawsuit. You know, maybe there's a better way. And maybe we ought to start thinking about mechanisms and systems of dispute resolution. So it doesn't cost 10% in California, but maybe 3%. That's all I'm talking about. No, I don't want people killed in a fire in a chicken plant any more than you do. That's not the issue. We're not here to discuss that issue, because I don't disagree with anybody on those grounds. I'm here to say I think there are better ways to resolve disputes than having me hire a lawyer, Darlene hire a lawyer, and then bash it out without even talking to one another. Because the first thing they're going to tell me is, don't talk to anybody about this. But that's who I'm having the dispute with. Don't talk to her. I'll talk to her lawyer. But we'll never see each other. Unless I get real bold and not follow my lawyer's advice and call her and say, all right, let's work this out. Okay? But typically, most people are scared to do that. I found that to be the case. I'm amazed at how many people have disputes and won't talk to the people they're disputing with.
You don't think that's good advice as a lawyer if you have two people getting a divorce and to tell one of them, don't talk to that person?
Tell your story about the two people.
I did. I did. Why if you feel that you could work this out with that other person, if you feel that there are some things that you could work out between the two of you in a non-confrontational way, why wouldn't you do that?
Stay married.
No, I'm sorry. They've already passed that bridge.
Yeah.
Okay? They've gone. Look, I don't advocate divorce.
I think your case is the exception, and most of them is a case where there has been a dominant situation where someone is getting out of the relationship, and it's good to advise that person, look, you get back to talking to that person making deals, and you're going to get sucked into it again. My advice to you as a lawyer is, don't talk to them. And I think it's good advice.
Okay.
We have laws in this country that are to protect people against age discrimination, and yet a growing number of them, and many of them are making the public news all the time, of people who are fired obviously because they're too expensive, because they're older, and they have their best burning years time. And a growing number of businesses, including churches, are dealing with their older workers in that way. Even though we have laws that supposedly protect. I get very cynical when I begin to talk about this because I've been advised there's nothing we can do about it, we have to live with it. And yet, what's the purpose of the law if it doesn't protect?
First of all, I don't hold myself out to be an expert on the law or the judicial process to begin with. That I picked up as secondary in my investigation of dispute resolution. My purpose is to say, I think in many circumstances where somebody feels that their rights have been violated, there are better ways to resolve those disputes than take them to the court, okay? Than filing a lawsuit and going through a very expensive, wrenching process. That's my point. Now, I can't disagree that in certain circumstances, you have a battered wife, that there's some good that's gonna come out of putting two people in a room. That's not my point. But the example I did use does occur, okay? Where two people have said, yeah, we think we can work through the basics of this thing without it becoming a confrontational process. I applaud that. I don't want to be told, don't do it. You know, I don't want to be told that's not the way it should be done. And we live in a very confrontational society today, I think, because of it.
And don't they use the ombudsman process over in Europe rather effectively?
Well, we actually use it fairly effectively in the United States. I want to. We ran out of time again.
You didn't say anything about my issue.
Huh?
You didn't say anything about my issue.
Your issue is the issue that I raised right here, and that is that if you price something beyond what it's worth in the marketplace, organizations will make adjustments to that, okay? They will adjust to it. If I can build something using Taiwanese workers, even if it means building a new plant, exporting some capital across the sea, and I have to make a choice between that and continuing to operate my plant here, however that is done, and that's a choice I have to make, then those are fairly clear choices. My point in using the employer example on wrongful termination was that laws to protect people will create behavior changes, all right, that will serve to mitigate against the protections that you started.
In other words, for every law, there's a way to get around it.
Partially, that's the case. Because many
people or groups find ways to get around.
Well, you look at it. Look at it this way. Am I firing somebody because they're over 40, or am I firing somebody because they're not as productive? Am I firing somebody because they're over 40, or am I firing them because if I add up the cost of their medical coverage, their pension, and their salary, I can't afford them? Now, those are two entirely different circumstances.
There's another issue, though. There's the human issue. What are people to do when they get older and need to work until they're 65 but cannot find a job? There's a human issue involved. And
right.
And I say,
right.
I see it especially in the church. I'm a retired minister. I did not get victimized by my age because I was able to find a job at a late stage in my employment years. But I know many other people in various professions, and including a growing number of pastors nowadays, who, if they get much beyond 50, unless they can find a way to stick in and get a tough enough hide to stick in until they're 65, they're pushed out.
Oh, but it's not pastors. I mean, look at the layoffs in corporate America in the last 2 years.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's in all professions.
Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of salaried people, wage and salaried people, walking the streets with no hope of duplicating the job they have. No hope at all. Middle management, senior management, they are not going to find jobs. They're going to have to find something that is maybe in a totally new field. That's what I did. or they're going to have to find something at a totally different wage and salary level than they found before. They may have to relocate. And until this economy recovers, all of that's going to be very difficult.
With a lot of those companies, if they didn't have those layoffs, the company would go under and no one would have a job.
Right. That's my point. But that was my point. Are we firing somebody arbitrarily because they're over 40, or are we firing them because we can't afford them? Those are two entirely different things. Most companies will not walk up to somebody that's 52 years old, that's making $52,000 a year, with a pension, with medical coverage and so forth, and say, look, we can't afford you. We can afford to pay you $38,000 a year, reduce your pension a little bit, reduce your medical coverage a little bit, if you want to stay on, but they won't do that. Which is better, firing them or trying to reduce their package so that you can afford them? I don't have the answer to that, I don't know. But those are choices that most people aren't given, and most companies are not willing to make.
As a clergyman, you can't prove anything about age. I mean, you know that there's discrimination.
Of course.
40 or
of course.
And
of course.
I know of one bishop who wouldn't even let a pastor into the district unless he retired, and he's only 60 years old.
You're right.
He didn't want to be responsible for anymore.